unbelievers' district was crowded when they arrived, the air thick with dust and the smells of fried food and animal dung. Shoppers and traders hawking their wares mingled in a cheerfully chaotic mass that made the more orderly markets of Gujara seem funereal by comparison. Then, too, Sunandi saw less pleasant reminders that they were no longer in Hananja City. Pickpockets roamed the crowd, a shopkeeper shouted insults at a recalcitrant customer, and dealers in shadier wares did brisk business on the fringes. Surreptitiously, she tucked her wrist purse into her travel robes. She worried at first that the two Gujarin, unused to the rough ways beyond their city's walls, might not be so careful. Yet Ehuru had already tucked his purse out of sight, and as usual the boy had taken cues from his master. To a point, Ehuru moved through the crowd with such calm and ease that no one could mistake him for the pious monster he truly was. But Najiri gaped open-mouthed at everything around him. He looked exactly like a runaway servant castboy getting his first glimpse of life beyond Gujara's walls. But she didn't think it was an act. She slowed as they came to an area where the crowds thinned to flow around a knot of camels, piles of packaged goods, and small animals in cages. A menagerie of folk, she noted Gujarin, Kisawati, Bromarte, Kasutsin, Sereni, and what looked like a Jelavi dancer, swarmed around and over the caravan like ants, checking harnesses and loading the camels. Sunandi spied a tall, broad woman with the fierce features of a far southerner, standing at the epicenter of the chaos. Before Sunandi could call out, the woman turned and noticed her. "Nefe!" she cried, opening her arms and beaming. "How long has it been, you brat? Come here and take your punishment." Sunandi smiled and went to the woman, who wrapped big arms around her in a mighty hug that picked her up several inches off the ground. She oofed but endured the hug, chuckling in spite of herself, as the woman finally released her and gave her a narrow-eyed look, still gripping her by the shoulders. From the corner of her eye, she could see the gatherers staring. "You need something again." "Ache," the woman made a face. "You never come around unless you do. Because you haven't run me off yet." Sunandi gestured toward the two Gujarin. "My companions and I need passage to Kiswa, quickly and quietly." The woman glanced at the men and grunted in disinterest before turning her attention back to Sunandi. "You know I'll take you, Nefe, but it won't be a comfortable journey. We're going the desert route, not the river way. Nothing along the river but poor villages that can't afford to pay us. At least in Tessa we'll make a profit." Sunandi grimaced. "I'd actually hope to hear you say that. The desert route is faster."
"You hate the high desert, you spoiled soft thing."
"I won't complain. Haste is more important than comfort this time." The woman's smile faded. She examined Sunandi closely.
"You're in real trouble."
"I am, Anu." Gehanu did not ask further, though she gave Sunandi's shoulders a firm, reassuring squeeze. "And we'll get you out there. Should only take 7 days by the Oasis Road. Where's that pale girl of yours? She complains more than you do." Sunandi lowered her eyes, and the woman caught her breath. "Moon's mad light. So that's it. Then we need to go now, I'm thinking." She finally turned to the two Gujarin. "I'm Gehanu. You?" Sunandi saw the boy glance uncertainly at Ehuru. Ehuru bowed over one hand, and the boy quickly imitated him. He spoke in Sua. "I am Ehuru, and this boy is Neri. We will work for our passage, mistress." Sunandi blinked in surprise. Ehuru had hunched his shoulders and raised the pitch of his voice, making it slightly nasal. He kept his eyes lowered in the manner of a humble low-caste man. Together with his high-caste accent, it was perfect for the role they'd given him. a once wealthy Kisawati, now disinherited and humbled for some youthful indiscretion. She could see Gehanu assessing and dismissing him all at once.
"Of course you will, Che," Gehanu snapped. "We all work here. What can you do, boy?"
Najiri bowed deeper, a perfect Gujarin servant-caste bow, with a hand inflection indicating that he was unclaimed and willing to accept a new master. When he straightened, he looked at Gehanu with an ingenuous blend of shy hope and fear that was completely at odds with his true manner.
"I clean very well, mistress," he said. "I can do anything else if you show me but once. Except cooking."
He looked so crestfallen by this that Sunandi almost laughed. Gehanu did laugh, once and loudly, but it was clear the boy had charmed her.
"We'll make sure you get nowhere near the cook fire, then."
She glanced around at the caravanners and raised her voice in a thunderous shout, "Move yourselves, you lazy stones! We're striking out before sun-zenith!" The caravanners ignored her with the air of long practice. Ehuru nodded toward a group loading sacks into a wagon.
"Shall I help, mistress?" "If you think you can do it without cocking things up."
Gehanu jerked her head toward the wagon, and Ehuru nodded and went to join the loaders. She watched him go, a look of approval on her face.
"You, boy, can you sing?"
Najiri looked startled.
"Sing, mistress?"
"Yes, open your mouth, let sounds come out, occasionally with words." The boy's complexion, almost as pale as a northerner's, turned a startling pink.
"Not well, mistress."
"Dance?" "Only prayer dances, mistress, same as any Gujarin. It's a start. And in the south you might actually be a novelty." She glanced at Sunandi. "You're a friend. Your pretty-speaking man isn't, but taking on passengers isn't something the others would question, if those passengers look like they can pay. Gujarin servant castes aren't permitted to accumulate money. So our young friend here will be a dancer. I'm considering for apprenticeship and permanent hire."
"Che?"
Najiri looked startled. A sharp needle of cold threaded Sunandi's spine. She hadn't made such a stupid amateur mistake in years. Kinja would have swatted her for it. Lin would have been shocked. It took only one minor inconsistency, any error of logic, to arouse suspicions. There were many among a minstrel band who would gladly earn extra money reporting suspicious strangers to gate guards or trade post officials. She could have gotten them all killed. Gehanu saw her horror and took her by the arm, leading her toward the camels and beckoning for Najiri to follow.
So woo, Nefe. Don't worry. I'll take care of you like I always do. We'll get you back home fast as Skyrers, and then all will be well.
Che? It was said that the gods favored fools because they were entertaining to watch. Privately thanking whichever god had found her amusing for the time being, Sunandi leaned gratefully against Gehanu.
Ah, Che.
The caravan line had already formed. 6 unladen camels trailed at the rear to be sold along the journey. Gehanu ordered 3 of these saddled for Sunandi and her companions, and as the sun peaked overhead, they set off along the dusty, heat-hazed road. Chapter 19. A gatherer shall, under the guidance of the sentinel path, strengthen body and mind for the rigors of her service. He shall strike quickly and decisively in her name, that peace may follow just as swiftly. Law. Robina landed on a rooftop near the Hedua Plaza, panting and shivering. Too much dream blood. He'd been gathering nearly every night since Una Une's death, and twice on some nights since Ehuru had begun his penance. So many in the city called for a gatherer's services. It was cruel to make them wait. He sat down behind a storage shed and leaned his head against its wall, waiting for the giddiness to pass. He was not Ehuru. His dreaming gift had never been strong. It would be good, very good, when things finally returned to normal in the Hedua. The sound of footsteps on the stones of the plaza below did not disturb Robina at first. Dreamblood still sang in his soul, suffusing his mind with its warm glow. Servants heading home after late-night labors, maybe? What did it matter? But gradually, awareness penetrated the haze, and he noticed that the walkers were moving briskly, staying close together. Occasionally, the rhythm of the steps jarred as one or another jogged a little to keep up. And one set of steps lagged from time to time, its emphasis shifting from one foot to the other and back again. In his mind's eye, Robina saw the owner of these steps, trotting along with his fellows, but periodically glancing around as if to check for observers. Robina opened his eyes. Another gathering was beyond his capacity at the moment, but he could certainly mark a new tithe-bearer for a later visit. Rolling to a crouch, he crept to the edge of the rooftop and peered over, hoping to glimpse the culprit's face. They were almost across the plaza, headed for a street 2 blocks to Robina's right. He counted 3 men, 2 acting as guards for another between them. They were too far away to see clearly. The dreamer had set, leaving the streets dim and dull beneath waking moon's paltry light. But their noisy footfalls might as well have been a lantern to a gatherer. Quietly, along the rooftops, Robina followed. The artisan's district blended into a higher caste area that lined the most beautiful part of the river. A Xinha neighborhood. The houses here varied wildly from the traditional Gujarin style, incorporating architecture from 12 foreign cultures with little care for practicality, only aesthetic distinctiveness. Here Robina was forced to slow down, for one building had a rooftop of flat-sloping plates that was maddeningly difficult to navigate, and another bore so many elaborately carved statues of monsters around its edge that he could find no easy access. Privately cursing fools with more money than taste, he finally found one roof with neat overlapping shelves of baked brick. He had to go on hands and toes to distribute his weight and avoid breaking them, but he made it across and onto the proper Gujarin roof beyond that, which allowed him to catch up. When his quarry stopped, so did he. 3 men stood at the side door of a sprawling house. The size meant the house was surely owned by one of the older Xinha lineages, but Robina did not recognize the family pictorials decorating the lintel. When the door opened, neither did he recognize the man who beckoned the 3 guests in, likely just a servant anyhow. But he did finally recognize the 3 men when the light from the doorway illuminated their faces. The superior, and the sentinels Dinyeru and Jeket. In her name and inward sight, Robina caught his breath. The door closed behind them. Robina began searching for a way onto that roof. If he could swing down into a window or hang from a balcony. He spotted the danger and froze. Another man stood on the roof of the Xinha house, scratching himself in the shadows of a chimney. Short shorn hair, short sword on one hip, bronze half-torso armor whose gleam was obscured by a rust-colored evening drape. A sunset guard? That meant the superior was meeting with someone from Yanya Eon, someone who held the sanction of the prince himself. Looking around, Robina's eyes sifted 7 guards from the pre-dawn shadows, a total of 3 on the rooftop of the house, another 3 scattered around the rooftops of nearby buildings, a 7th on the ground and standing quietly near the house's stable. Not enough. The guard moved in 4s. Where was the 8th? The faint grit of a footstep behind made Robina's skin prickle. He forced himself not to react, even though he imagined a fiery line along the center of his back, where the guardsman's impending stab was doubtless aimed. When instinct told him his enemy was close enough, he struck, twisting about to slap at the flat of the blade. The guardsman jerked in surprise and struggled to bring the blade around again, but by then Robina was on him, tackling him to the ground so that the other guards wouldn't see the struggle. Before the man could cry out, Robina slapped one hand over his mouth and used the other to set his scarab Jungisa humming and lay it on the man's forehead. He stiffened, paralyzed but still awake. His terror and fury fought the magic. Robina smiled and forked two fingers toward the man's eyes. They closed reflexively, and Robina laid his fingers on them, reinforcing the Jungisa's magic with a powerful narcomantic command. It took long, taut breaths, but at last the rigidity went out of the guard's body. He sagged into sleep. Leaving the Jungisa in place, it would hold the sleep spell. Robina returned to the edge of the roof. Six figures still patrolled calmly on the rooftops, the seventh on the ground. He had not been seen. Grinning to himself, Robina headed across the roof, moving on fingers and toes again. Carefully, he swung himself over the edge and dropped to a window, bracing his toes on the sill. Inside, he could hear someone snoring enthusiastically. He dropped again, catching the sill with his hands, grunting just a bit as his knuckles scraped against the wall. He grunted a second time when he dropped to the ground, this time landing in a crouch. San Tai, his former mentor, would tisk at all the noise he was making, but it could not be helped. He was not as young nor as lean as he had once been, alas. And this was not a mission to share Hanangio's peace. The rules for spying were surely different. He went to the corner of the building he'd just descended and flicked a glance around. One guard still stood near the stables, pacing back and forth. Doubtless the house's servant entrance was in there. The main entrance was also within his sight. But Robina did not need an entrance. A window would do for his purposes. He glanced up and watched a while, noting that the roof guards peered down at the ground only occasionally. There was an alley directly across the street that ran behind the Xinhua house. If any of the guards happened to glance down while he was crossing, or if the stable guard turned his way, nothing to be done but trust in Hanangio. Whispering a quick prayer, Robina waited until the stable guard paced in the other direction, then darted across the street. There was no outcry, so he slipped deeper into the shadows and began making a circuit of the house. The first set of windows were useless, bedrooms with someone sleeping in each. The second set were another matter, for they opened onto the kitchens. Warm, spice-scented air wafted out through the hangings. He could hear servants within preparing food to serve the guests. Perfect. He climbed the side of the building quickly, using the window as his starting point, and then shifting to a ceramic gutter pipe that ran from the roof. When he reached the upper set of windows, he stopped, finding toeholds along the bracers of the pipe, for he had found what he sought. The superior's voice could be heard clearly from inside. "No, right," the voice said. Robina raised his eyebrows. It was nearly a snarl. The superior rarely displayed such anger in the Hedua. "I have every right," replied a different voice, in a venomous tone, also familiar, though Robina could not place it. "You did no less to my father, and if I hadn't taken matters into my own hands, you'd be doing the same to me. I consider the return of my brother a step toward repayment for those crimes." "You don't understand him," said the superior. "He believes. Her law is in his blood, in his very soul. Manipulate him like this, and he won't bend to become your tool. He will break." That is possible, but when he breaks, it will be in your direction. He'll spend his fury on the Hetawa, then turn to me for comfort. And I shall offer it to him gladly, because blood is still stronger than any oath.
Ahuru, Robina realized with a chill. They spoke of Ahuru. And that meant the other speaker was not some spokesman, but the prince himself.
He doesn't know what you are. The superior's voice dripped loathing. If he did, he'd gather you himself.
I am only what you made me, the prince said. He spoke so softly that Robina strained to hear his voice.
What do you think he'll do to you when he learns that?
The superior did not respond, and when the prince spoke again, his tone had changed.
And my brother is what you made him, so unfortunately I realize he cannot be trusted. Are you certain it was her?
Absolutely, said a third voice. Robina did not recognize this one at all. One of my men spotted her in the market. She joined a minstrel caravan that left the city at sunzenith yesterday. I've had the gate men dismissed for failing to detain them.
And Ahuru was with her, the prince sighed. I thought gatherers were honorable.
You dare! The superior sounded apoplectic. If Ahuru judges the woman corrupt, he'll take her.
I can't wait for him to make up his mind, the prince snapped. If the woman reaches Kiswa, there's no telling what the protectors will do. I need them surprised, frightened, predictable. He sighed. Sharis, send a messenger pigeon south. Can our troops there overtake the caravan?
If the minstrels took the river route easily, if they went through the desert, it will be more difficult. Every caravan follows its own route, but if they pass through Tessa, my men can catch them.
See that they do.
The prince's voice had the edge of command.
Will you kill her right before Ahuru's eyes? Asked the superior. Will you rub his nose in your corruption and still expect him to serve you?
There was a moment of silence.
He'll see it eventually, superior, the prince said, his voice heavy with meaning. Corruption is all around him, after all.
The superior said nothing to this. The third man, Sharis, cleared his throat in the uncomfortable silence that fell.
What of the gatherer after the woman is dead? Sharis finally asked. Or if he has already killed her?
I keep my promises to my brother, said the prince. If he's killed her, then escort him back here and allow him to return to the Hetawa. All charges against him will be dropped. Won't they, superior?
In a low voice, the superior replied, Yes.
If he has not killed her, the prince continued, then our bargain is forfeit. Capture him and bring him back. But to Yanya Eon, unharmed, please. I'll have another use for him.
You dare not. That from the superior, seething with fury and fear, Robina sensed. You dare not.
I dare far more than you could ever imagine, superior.
There was a pause. Ceramic clinked against ceramic as liquid poured.
Now go scurry back to your little hole, and cower there until I have need of you.
To Robina's amazement, the superior did not react to this contempt. Cloth shifted, and sandals shuffled. The meeting was over. Quickly, Robina climbed down the pipe and dashed back through the alley and across the street to the building next door. The shadows engulfed him just as the door of the Xinhua house opened. The superior emerged, gesturing curtly for his sentinel attendants to follow, and they headed away into the night. Climbing up to the roof, Robina returned to where the guard lay sleeping, the scarab Jungisa still humming faintly on his forehead.
You're a fortunate man, Robina whispered, removing the stone and laying fingers over the man's eyes. You'll have a pleasant dream of shirking your duty and taking a nap. Your captain will likely punish you, but not with your life. That is because you won't remember seeing me up here,
except as a fragment of a dream. He wove the dream into the man's mind as he spoke. It was not the most ethical application of narcomancy, but perhaps Hananja would forgive the misuse because his intentions were pure. And because the life of a path brother was at stake, though only the gods knew what could be done about it at this point. It was enough that they knew, Robina decided, and he hurried home to share the knowledge with Santayi. Chapter 20. Tell me, Mother Moon, oh tell me, ay-yay, when will Brother Sleep come calling, ay-yay, an-yay, ay-yay, on the night of river dancing, ay-yay, oh-yay, ay-yay, in the peace of moonlight dreaming, ay-yay, hi-yay, ay-yay, tell me, Mother Moon, oh tell me, ay-yay, koo-yay, ay-yay, who will bring my brother home? Ay-yay, see-yay, ay-yay, though I welcome him with singing. Ay-yay, nigh-yay, ay-yay, must I sing my song alone? Wisdom. On the first day out of the city, the caravan crossed a tributary of the goddess's blood, passing through a village called Ketuye. There Najiri had gotten his first glimpse of how the folk of the upriver towns lived. The rhythmic work songs of the washing women lingered in his mind, as did less pleasant memories of human wretchedness. Some of the structures used as homes in Ketuye were little more than lean-tos made of mud and sticks and palm leaves. The village was too tiny to merit a satellite temple of Hananja. Najiri saw only a single overworked sharer whose hut was barely finer than the lean-tos. There were no public crypts for the dead, just patches of ground where bodies, not even burned, had been crudely shoveled into the earth. He saw no clean well, no bathhouse. He couldn't tell the high castes from the servants. When he asked a fellow member of the caravan how children in the village were schooled, he got only a shrug in response. Now Ketuye was a fond memory. They had been traveling hard for 2 days since, passing first through arid rocky foothills and then into the vast windswept dunes of the empty thousand. The desert was not actually 1,000 miles wide, Najiri understood, but it was hard to believe otherwise, when from the back of his camel he could see nothing but sand and heat haze in every direction. The remaining 4 days of the journey felt as though they might as well be 1,000 years. He had lost himself in unhappy contemplation of the grit in his eyes, the heat, and the rivulets of sweat tickling his back, when he was shocked out of misery by cold water splashing onto his face and neck. He yelped and glanced around to see Kanek, one of Gehanu's sons, grinning at him from another camel with an open canteen in his hands. "Wake up, city boy!" Kanek was grinning. "We're almost there!" "There?" Najiri blinked away water, trying to comprehend. They couldn't be at Kiswa yet. And why was Kanek wasting water? "The oasis at Tessa, city boy. See?" He pointed ahead. Najiri followed the arm and saw what at first seemed to be just another mirage, glinting against the horizon. Then he noticed the palm trees spiking toward the sky, and buildings squatting around their trunks. Kanek splashed more water at him. "We'll get to bathe soon, and drink all we want, and wash our clothes so we no longer smell like dung heaps. So wake up!" His good humor was infectious, and Najiri started splashing water at Kanek in return, giving him a good wetting before Gehanu turned and glared them back to discipline from several camels ahead. Still, the spirits of the whole caravan seemed to lift as the news spread. Najiri glanced around for Ehuru, wondering if he dared splash his brother, and his fine mood dissipated at once. Ehuru's camel plodded along near the rear of the caravan, moving more slowly than its fellows. Atop it, Ehuru rode with his head down and headcloth hanging round his face, giving no sign that he had heard the news.
"Go wake your friend," Kanek said, following Najiri's gaze. "I think he's still in the desert."
Najiri nodded and reined in his camel, dropping back through the caravan column until he rode abreast with Ehuru. "Brother," he said. He kept his voice low, though none of the other caravanners were close enough to overhear anyhow. Ehuru's head lifted slowly. He focused on Najiri as if from a great distance. "Najiri, all is well?"
"Obviously not, brother."
"Have you not heard? We will reach Tessa soon."
"So soon? Good."
He spoke softly, but Najiri heard the detachment in his voice. This was how the change always began with the Pranjay. The gatherer's attention gradually turned inward to focus on the coming struggle, sparing little for the non-essentials of personality or emotion. That would be the only sign on the surface at first. But somewhere within Ehuru, in the formless space between flesh and soul, the umblike that kept him whole was dry and cracking. Without dream blood to nourish it, that tether would fray, loosening his soul to swing uncontrollably between waking and dreaming. Eventually the tether would snap, and Ehuru's soul would fly free into death, but not before he had lost all ability to tell vision from reality. And while Ehuru struggled to keep his mind intact, his soul would be hungry, so hungry, for the peace that Dreamblood could give him. If his control faltered even once, "If he falters, I must gather him." Was he ready for that? Barely trained as he was, far from home, under the duress of time. No, of course he wasn't. And even if he could somehow make himself ready, could he then keep perfect peace in his heart, as a gatherer should? More heavily than he needed to, Najiri put a hand on Ehuru's. "It may be some hours yet before we reach the oasis, brother," he said to distract himself. "Are you hungry?" He rummaged among his robes and found one of the cloth sachets of food that had been given out at the last rest hour. "I have a hecaseed cake left over from breakfast. Gehanu soaks them in honey." He peeled the sticky treat free and held it out. Ehuru glanced at it, shuddered as if the sight made him queasy, and looked away. Najiri frowned. "What is it, brother?" Ehuru said nothing. A vision, then. Too soon. It had been only 3-4 days since Ehuru had given his last tithe to the sharers. Najiri kept his tone even and said, "Tell me what you saw, brother. Please." Ehuru sighed. "Insects." Najiri grimaced and began to rewrap the cake. Most visions were harmless, but like pain with the body, unpleasant vision served as a warning for the mind, indicating imbalance or injury. It was a thing that sharers could deal with on a temporary basis, siphoning off the excess dream bile, adding sufficient dream ichor to restore the inner equilibrium, perhaps other things. Najiri had never learned much more than basic healing techniques, but only dream blood could cure it. "There aren't any, but I'll hold this until the vision has passed, if you like."
"No," Ehuru said.
He reached over and broke off a piece of the cake, lifted it to his mouth without looking, and ate it, chewing grimly. "It was only a vision. Eat the rest yourself." Najiri obeyed, shifting to ease the ache in his buttocks. If he never rode another camel, he would die in peace. "We can rest properly tonight, brother," Najiri said. He hesitated and then added, "And you can draw dream blood from me, just enough to stave off—"
"No."
Najiri opened his mouth to protest, but Ehuru forestalled him with a small, pained smile. My control was weak the last time you offered. Now it is gone altogether. I have no wish to kill you, my apprentice." His choice of words chilled Najiri despite the desert heat. "Gathering is not killing, brother."
"Either way, you would be dead," Ahiru sighed, lifting his head to gaze toward the distant oasis. "In any case, there may be another way."
"What?" Ahiru nodded toward the middle of the caravan. A light palanquin of balsa wood and linen bobbed among the river of cloth-wrapped heads, carried by sturdy young men on the smoothest gaited of the camels. From within the palanquin came the sound of a racking, weary cough.
"Their matriarch," Ahiru said very softly. "I have heard such a cough before.
I would guess she suffers hardened lungs, or perhaps the sickness of tumors."
"Dreambile could cure the latter if she has the strength to bear it," Najiri said, trying to recall his sharer lessons.
He had seen the old woman during their rest hours. She was a cheerful little creature, who had probably been spry before her illness, 70 floods at least. Her old body would be slower to respond to the healing power of the humors, but the effort wasn't hopeless.
"I know nothing of hardened lungs, though," he trailed off, seeing suddenly what Ahiru meant.
"Oh."
Ahiru nodded, watching the palanquin. She could have visited the Hedawa before the minstrels left Gujara, but she didn't.
"She does not want to be healed." Najiri stifled excitement. It was the best of all possible circumstances.
And yet Ahuru's angry words from a few nights before, after Najiri had recovered from the Reaper attack, lingered in his mind.
"So, you've changed your mind about testing yourself."
He did not say facing the Pranjay, for one did not speak of such things while among layfolk, even quietly.
"No, I still intend to submit myself to her judgment. But I must seek Dreamblood now, or become dangerous to our companions," he sighed.
"Once I settle the matter of the Hedawa's corruption, then I can contemplate my own."
"Yes, brother." Najiri tried to feel glad for that respite.
"Of course, there is one blessing in this. You'll finally have the chance to assist in a gathering."
Najiri caught his breath. He had not considered that at all.
"Will you speak with her, brother? Tonight? May I attend?"
Ahiru mustered a rough chuckle, which drove back some of Najiri's worry. If Ahiru was still capable of humor, he was not as far gone as Najiri had feared.
"Tonight, yes. I shall assay. You may attend if she wishes it, my greedy apprentice."
Then he sobered. "This serves our purposes, Najiri. But we must never forget that the tithe-bearer's needs come first."
"Yes, brother."
They fell silent for the rest of the ride into Tessa. Palm trees rose out of the sand until they loomed more and more like mountains the closer they drew. The town beneath was clearly far more prosperous than Keriye had been. Narrow fields ran between the houses, taking advantage of an irrigation system that appeared to have been haphazardly rigged throughout the town with fired clay pipes. Potted plants grew wherever the pipes wouldn't go, on balconies and rooftops and street corners. The sight of so much green lifted Najiri's spirits again. He darted a glance at Ahiru and was pleased to see that his mentor seemed to have regained a measure of alertness as well, sitting straighter on his camel and looking about with interest. Children came forth at once to surround the caravan, chattering in a syrupy dialect of Gujarine that Najiri found barely comprehensible. They offered sweets, flasks of water, flowers, and other welcoming trinkets. Adults came out of their houses or looked up from their work, waving. Gehanu, apparently well known to the townsfolk, waved back and called greetings as they rode along. The caravan kept moving forward until the street widened and they faced the oasis itself. A a circular pond surrounded on all sides by a low wall, only a few dozen feet across, but clearly the heart of the village. All the roads ran to it. Irrigation lines radiated from its walls like the spokes of a wheel. Here the troop stopped and dismounted, tethering the camels near troughs that had been set aside for watering animals. Gehanu walked through the group, calling out instructions and the rules of the town. Guard the caravan's goods in shifts, disputes weren't allowed at the water's edge, and everyone was required to pay at least one visit to the village baths. "Or none of the maidens or lads here will look twice at you," she said. A group of passing Tessa girls giggled to emphasize her point. Najiri spent a while unloading and feeding the camels along with all the others. He spied the palanquin on the ground and surreptitiously watched as a young man helped the old woman walk around to ease the stiffness of her legs. She stopped every few steps to let out a series of hollow, wheezing coughs. Each one left her visibly drained, leaning harder on the young man's arm. She was thin and weak, and had probably been ill for months. Najiri's heart tightened in sympathy and anger. "Thinking killing thoughts, boy?" Najiri started and turned to see Sunandi nearby, pouring a vase of water into the animal's trough. She looked every inch the rough caravanner. Her full lips were now chapped. Her skin was dry, and gone were the brightly colored wraps she'd worn at Etisero's, along with the earrings and the looping necklaces. Here she wore only shapeless layered robes in earthen tones, same as the rest of them, the only sensible attire for the high desert. The headcloth with which she'd covered her short shorn hair did accent her angular, large-eyed face nicely. Najiri reluctantly had to admit that she was quite beautiful. But aside from that, she might as well have been just another juggler or dancer with the caravan troupe. She did not look at him as she worked, and she kept her voice down, but he heard the edge in her tone. "You believe it better for her to suffer like that?" he asked. "A sharer could have eased her pain. For a price. A few dreams. From such an old one they would have been rich. All Gujara could benefit from the power within her." She straightened and mopped her brow with one sleeve, then glared at him. "You sound like a vulture," she said. "Circling round the week, waiting for your chance to feed. All your kind, pious, well-meaning scavengers." Najiri felt heat, then cold, run through him. He set down the saddlebag he'd been carrying and turned to face her. "You grieve for your north-blooded girl," he said, keeping his voice low. "No one has eased the pain for you, so I'll forgive that insult. But you, with your life steeped in lies and corruption, can comprehend none of Hananja's blessings. For that I pity you." She stared back at him. Not trusting himself to be civil any longer, Najiri turned and headed toward the oasis, where Ehuru was helping some of the others distribute water to the animal troughs. Najiri joined him and wordlessly helped him until the task was done. Then Ehuru, who of course had noticed his mood, took his arm and pulled him to a quiet spot beside a feed seller's stall. "Tell me," was all he said, and Najiri did. By the time he'd finished telling the tale, his anger had been replaced by shame. Ehuru said nothing for a long while, watching him, and Najiri finally blurted, "I shouldn't have gotten angry. She was in pain. I should have comforted her." "Yes," Ehuru said, "but I suspect she wanted no comfort from one she blames for the death of her girl."
"I didn't kill her girl. The abomination did that."
"To her, you and the Reaper, and I, are one and the same." Najiri folded his arms over his chest, shifting from foot to foot. "I've never understood why anyone fears gathering," he said.
"Barbarians know no better. But the Kisawati worship Hananja, if not in the same way as us, They're civilized.
He glanced at Ahuru and saw a rueful smile on his mentor's lips.
Civilization may not be all you think, Najiri.
Ahuru took Najiri's shoulder in a comforting grip for a moment, then pulled Najiri to walk with him toward the caravan. But in the future, when a tithe-bearer attacks with anger, and you feel anger in response, think of your mother.
Najiri stopped walking, startled.
My mother? But she died in peace.
The North-blooded girl did not.
My mother died in peace, too, Ahuru said. Not with the Gatherer's aid, but through her own goddess strength. Yet still I wished for years afterward that she had not died. Even knowing that I would see her again in Ina Karek, I thought only of the fact that I could never talk to her, never feel her arms around me, never breathe her scent, not while I yet lived. Sometimes I feel that pain still. Do you?
And suddenly the old ache was there in Najiri's heart, sharper than it had been for years.
Yes.
And as he said it, he understood. If he still felt such pain years later, knowing that his mother had died well, how much worse must the pain be for Sunandi, whose agony was still raw and exacerbated by the horrible circumstances of the child's death?
You see, Ahuru said.
He stopped then, and they both looked up. The caravan was beginning to settle, pitching tents in a paved square set aside for that purpose by the village folk. On the other side of the square, a little girl helped the old woman into a large, ornately decorated round tent.
Those in pain deserve our compassion, Najiri said, his thoughts on that long-ago day in his servant's hovel.
I won't forget again, brother.
Ahuru nodded, and together they returned to the tents to prepare for the gathering.
Chapter 21 A gatherer shall immediately bring all tithes collected to the Hetawa, to be entrusted to his brethren of the Sharer Path. Only the merest portion is to be kept by the gatherer himself. Law. Ahuru resumed his fallen aristocrat's guise and found Gehanu in her tent. Have you any ether root, mistress? In some lands they call it get. Gehanu paused in the middle of chewing some sort of spiced meat on a skewer. Village women had come among the minstrel band during the unpacking, selling food and drink. You planning to put someone to sleep? Ahuru smiled and touched his own torso, just below his ribcage. Get can ease spasms here. It sometimes stops a cough. Her eyebrows rose. Ah, for Telethelech, eh? Is that the name of your elder?
Yes, mistress.
You don't look like a healer.
There are healers in my family, mistress. Some even serve the Hetawa in Gujara. I picked up a few tricks.
Hold on. Kanek! Her bellow almost caught Ahuru by surprise, but he had grown used to the woman's rough mannerisms over the past few days. There was a shuffle outside, and then Kanek poked his head into the tent, scowling. Go find the village headman and ask for get root, Gehanna told him. Get? Palm wine tastes better, mother. Just do it, you disrespectful Shifa. She glared until the boy disappeared. They heard his grumbles as his footsteps faded. Thank you, mistress. Ahuru flattened both his hands and bowed over them. Ete sowu sowu. Ahuru thought the language might have been Penko, but he could not be certain. Her Gujarin was fluent, at least, though she tended to speak too fast. It took time for him to sift out the words from her accent. If you can make Talithale more comfortable, it'll be worth getting in debt with the greedy old bastard who runs this town. She set down the skewer and rummaged among her robes for a moment, finally coming up with a long pipe. She raised her voice again. And an ember from the fire! A faint, annoyed sound was the only reply. Ahuru smiled. It's good to have dependable sons. Ace, like that boy of yours, hm? I see him hovering always, making sure no one bothers you much, taking care of problems before you notice. She did not see Eiru's look of surprise as she rummaged again and came up with dried leaves, which she began to pack into the pipe. If only my sons were as clever and thoughtful. Though, of course, Neri isn't your son. She glanced up at him, her big southerner eyes bright and sharp. No, mistress, he is not. She grunted and bit another piece of meat off the skewer.
Bed warmer?
Eiru smiled at the notion. Protégé, I'm teaching him about life. Gehanu grunted in amusement.
And he listens. Motro Sonii, a miracle to amaze even the gods.
He listens when it suits him, Eiru smiled. Young men.
Too young for sense, too old to beat. But young women are worse, trust me. 3 daughters back home, along with my 3 other sons. Should probably beat my husband for inflicting all of them on me. But he's pretty, and he doesn't eat much, so I keep him around.
She cocked her head, examining him.
You're pretty. You have a wife?
Eiru heartily wished that Kanek would hurry back. No, mistress.
You looking?
She grinned, flashing a substantial gap between her front teeth. In the southern lands, this marked a woman of great passion, or so Eiru had heard. No, mistress.
Why not?
I'm a servant, mistress. He and Ajiri had decided to keep up their guise at all times, though Gehanu had already guessed that they were not what they seemed. She didn't know the whole truth, and there was no way of knowing who might be listening through thin tent walls.
Got to make more servants somehow, Che? Nefe is pretty.
Eiru forced a laugh.
True, but she is of a different world, mistress.
Yes. No time for children anyway, that one.
Always busy she is, always worried about something. She needs a nice, mellow man like you, but she'll never slow down enough for that.
The flap lifted again, much to Ehuru's relief, and Kanek slipped inside. Get! He set a small bladder, tied with a leather cord, down on the tent rug.
What did the head man want for it? Gehanu asked.
Nothing. He was so surprised that we wanted it that he gave it to me without asking anything in trade.
He must be getting senile. Good. I'll trade more with him tomorrow. Now go bathe, you reek.
Kanek rolled his eyes behind Gehanu's back, winked and grinned at Eiru, and left. Eiru bowed humbly in thanks and reached for the bladder. Gehanu's hand fell on his own, forestalling him.
You understand our ways are different from yours, Che?
Her mouth stretched in something that was not quite a smile. Her eyes were serious.
I know her time will come soon. I'm not a fool. But remember, she did not ask for you.
Eiru froze, realizing all at once what she meant, and wondering how she'd figured it out, and deciding at last that it made no difference. Such things were Hananja's will. I shall respect her wishes, he said, discarding the affected manner of speech he'd used before. Her life does no harm, so her death is her choice. Gehanu gave him a long and assessing look, but finally nodded and let his hand go.
I met one of your kind once, long ago, she said. Came to take a Gujarine in our troop whose appendix had burst. He was quiet and strange like you, but there was great kindness in his eyes.
Eiru let go of the bladder of ether, now that they both knew he didn't need it. If the old woman refused him, Gehanu's people could give it to her in a tea.
Is that how you knew me?
I suspected, but I wasn't certain. He wasn't sad like you.
I didn't think your kind got sad, or mad, or anything else.
She narrowed her eyes at him. And you aren't supposed to, are you?
What's wrong with you?
I'm preparing myself to die. What in the gods' names for? He could not bring himself to lie, though he knew the truth would make her uneasy. I destroyed a man's soul. Kehanu caught her breath and drew back, horror plain on her face. Then it faded, replaced by concern. Was it an accident? So few others had asked that question. It was a relief to not be assumed evil. Yes. He gazed down at his hands. And no. It was incompetence. I forgot my duty and let fear and prejudice dictate my actions. Only for a moment. But that was enough. She frowned. Do you intend to do it again? Of course not, but there are... Then stop your moaning and move on. She gestured with one hand and abruptly noticed the unlit pipe in it. Damn forgetful brat. She set the pipe down. My grandmother needs you, Gatherer, so wake up and do your job. Go on now. He blinked in surprise. You trust me to complete this task properly? Are you deaf? Ehuru opened his mouth, then closed it. She had given him her answer already. For a moment he was overwhelmed, his heart feeling as if it would burst from gratitude, and terror, too. For what if he should mishandle this gathering like the last one? No, Kehanu was right. Talithale needed the gatherer, Ehuru, not the miserable penitent of the past few days. He took a deep breath and straightened. I accept your commission. I shall prepare myself, and then speak with Talithale, Elder, to make an assay of truth. She inclined her head in approval as he got to his feet and left. Najiri was hovering nearby, of course. A bath first, Ehuru said, and wordlessly the boy followed him to the village's bathhouse. Ehuru paid for both of them, and a village man led them into the washing chamber, where they undressed and sat while the man scrubbed them both with palm fronds and acrid soap. After the rinse, they were led to the bathing chamber and left there to soak in the warm, oiled, and scented water. Najiri kept a respectful silence the whole time, allowing Ehuru a precious few moments to pray. When Ehuru had soaked enough, he was surprised to find that his mind was quiescent, his heart at peace. He lifted his head. Najiri had been watching him. When he saw Ehuru's eyes, he smiled. Come, Ehuru said. They left the pool, dried themselves, dressed in clean clothes, and then headed to Talithale's tent. Wait outside, he told Najiri, and the boy nodded and slipped into the shadows behind the tent. He would come if and when Ehuru called him, and that would happen only if Talithale wanted him there. The minstrel encampment had mostly settled for the evening, though some of the younger members had started an impromptu performance, playing lyre and cymbals at the water's edge. From within the tent, Ehuru heard silence. Talithale's attendant either had gone or slept along with her. If they had been Gujarin, he would have gone in without asking. Instead, he drummed his fingers against the taut hide of the tent wall. Elder, may we speak? There was a stir from within, followed by another of the old woman's racking coughs. After the cough stopped, he heard, As much as speech is possible, whoever you are, come. Ehuru slipped in through the tent flap. Within, the tent was spacious and comfortable, lit by a beeswax lantern that hung from the smoke hole. The honey scent did not quite disguise the smell of age and sickness, but Ehuru paid that no mind. Thick fur rugs covered the floor and cushioned the hard stone. The inner tent walls had been painted in brightly colored geometric patterns of some southern style he did not recognize. At the center of the chamber lay two pallets, but only one was occupied at the moment. The old woman was there, struggling to sit up and greet her visitor.
Eiru moved quickly to crouch at her side and prop her against a stack of cushions nearby.
"Forgive me, Talithale, Elder. I did not mean to interrupt your rest."